If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Before we get started, we want to tell you a bit about the sponsor of this week's History Extra podcast, Warner Hotels. If you're looking to escape to a picturesque corner of the UK for a few days, Warner Hotels has just the thing for you. Each hotel offers everything you could possibly need for the perfect weekend away. From unrivaled leisure facilities and inspiring live entertainment to delicious dining experiences and plenty of history for you to uncover. If this sounds like your kind of getaway, Warner Hotels is now offering a series of exciting weekend packages in 2024. Each three-night stay is at one of three historic hotels, with dinner, bed and breakfast included, plus a whole itinerary of fascinating talks and Q&As with a selection of BBC history experts, such as Tracy Borman, Susanna Lipscomb and James Holland. So what are you waiting for? Book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When I started doing the book, most Americans, including, I think, Lin-Manuel Miranda, when he first read the book, they knew two things about Alexander Hamilton. He is on the $10 bill in the United States, and they knew that he had died in a duel with Vice President Aaron Burr at the time. But that pretty much exhausted what most people knew. And yet, the more that I read about him, I realized that his personal story was far and away the most dramatic and, in fact, rather unbelievable story of any of the founders.
That was Ron Chernow talking about the American founding father, Alexander Hamilton.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today we're going to be talking to the American historian Ron Chernow, whose biography of the founding father Alexander Hamilton helped inspire the smash hit musical that recently arrived in the UK. Ron himself paid a visit to Britain a few weeks back, and we sent our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans, to London to meet him.
I'm joined by a prize-winning writer and historian, Ron Chernow, who's written biographies on John D. Rockefeller, George Washington, Ulysses S. Grant and Alexander Hamilton, who we're going to be talking about today. Thank you so much for joining us,
Ron. My pleasure. Thank you.
So Hamilton was a founding father of the United States of America and is the subject of a hugely successful hip-hop musical, which I'd love to talk about in a little while. But if we could first go back way beyond the musical, and for those listeners who might not be familiar with the figure of Alexander Hamilton, He had a remarkable career, much of which I hope we can explore. He was effectively George Washington's chief of staff during the American Revolutionary War, during which he also later gained military glory. After that, he founded the Bank of New York. He was a key figure in the creation of the Constitution, first Treasury Secretary of the United States under Washington's administration, and he died as a result of an infamous duel with Aaron Burr. Yet when you came to him, I believe in the late 1990s, you write that he was fading into obscurity. So why do you think this was, and what drew you to write about this American founding father?
I know, it seems comical now, the idea that Hamilton was fading into obscurity in 1998 when I started writing about it, because now he's the darling of Broadway, maybe soon to be the darling of the West End as well. Hamilton, I felt, had never gotten his due. I felt that of the so-called founding fathers of the United States, he was the most neglected and underappreciated and misunderstood of those figures. And Alexander Hamilton's political enemies were John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe. I just named presidents 2, 3, 4, and 5. I mean, if history is written by the victors, history had been very much written by Alexander Hamilton's enemies, so that he'd always been portrayed as this ferocious snob. He was the stooge of the plutocrats. But for most Americans, and again, you know, British audiences that see the show and they may feel that they're at a disadvantage in terms of knowing the history, Americans don't know their history very well either, so they won't be quite as much of a disadvantage as they'll think. But when I started doing the book, most Americans, including, I think, Lin-Manuel Miranda, when he first read the book, they knew two things about Alexander Hamilton. He is on the $10 bill in the United States, and they knew that he had died in a duel with Vice President Aaron Burr at the time. But that pretty much exhausted what most people knew. And yet the more that I read about him, I realized that his personal story was far and away the most dramatic and, in fact, rather unbelievable story of any of the founders. And also there was a feeling that he was kind of a second or third rate founder. And the more I read about his achievements were so monumental that I felt that he deserved to be up there on the pantheon with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin et al.
And I think a really fascinating aspect which comes out immediately in your book is that despite all of these achievements, remarkable achievements in American history, his origins were unexpected, I think, for some. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about his birth in the West Indies and the hardships he suffered as a young man.
Right. He was born on the island of Nevis, which made him a British subject, which is interesting in terms of what subsequently happens in his career. But then when he's around 10 or 11 years old, his family moves to St. Croix, which is today one of the U.S. Virgin Islands, but at the time was a Danish colony. And then Hamilton undergoes this ghastly series of misfortunes, like something out of Charles Dickens' novel. His parents were not married. His mother had been married before, and under the terms of that divorce, she could not legally remarry, which essentially consigned Alexander to being illegitimate, which was no small thing to have that stigma in the 18th century. But then what happens, his biological father, or we think his biological father, James Hamilton, who was Scottish, the younger son of a Scottish laird, James Hamilton abandons the family when Alexander is 11. His mother then dies when he is 13. He's then farmed out to a first cousin who commits suicide. So, you know, at 14 years old, he's illegitimate, you know, he's orphaned. He experienced this terrible series of calamities. And he's working as a clerk in a trading house. And it looks like he will be doomed forever to this small island in the Caribbean. But then what happens in 1772, when he's 17 years old, a monster hurricane hits St. Croix. It's thought that a tsunami may have rolled across the island as well. Hamilton sat down and wrote a letter, a description of the hurricane that was published in the local newspaper. And it was written in a very vivid, almost kind of Shakespearean prose, describing the experience of living through the hurricane. Well, all the local merchants on St. Croix suddenly discovered that they had this young prodigy in their midst, and Hamilton was largely self-educated. He was an autodidact throughout his life. They were so astonished by this letter describing the hurricane that they banded together, and they took up a collection to send him to the North American colonies, possibly with the idea that he would become a doctor and come back and tend to the island. That, of course, didn't happen. And so he's around 17 years old, 1772. He goes to the North American colonies, winds up in New York, and he doesn't know a soul. He doesn't have any connection in the world. He's armed with a few letters of introduction. That was it. And by an extraordinary series of circumstances, 5 years later, he ends up as aide-de-camp and chief of staff to General George Washington. So Hamilton was somebody who radiated genius as well as radiated charm. There was a quote that I always loved. Samuel Johnson said of meeting Edmund Burke, he said that Burke was so brilliant that if one day you sheltered under an awning from the rain and there was this stranger who was Edmund Burke, and you chatted with him for 5 minutes, and then 5 minutes later the rain stopped and you said goodbye and parted ways, by the end of the 5 minutes, you would have known you were in the presence of genius. And I think that was exactly how people responded to Hamilton, that his brilliance kind of overflowed with this brilliance and charm and wit. So his rise, I would say meteoric, which is a cliche, but it kind of gives new meaning to that term.
Right, and I think that really comes across in your book, is that he was such a frenetic character and full of energy and so unstoppable in many ways. But it was really the war and the opportunity of revolutionary war that allowed him to rise so swiftly. So could you perhaps talk about the revolutionary nature of the city that he found himself in?
Yeah, the Revolutionary War becomes Hamilton's great career opportunity. I mean, he believed in it, but I think he also saw it as an opportunity to rise in the world. Okay, he went to King's College in Lower Manhattan. King's College, after the Revolutionary War, was renamed Columbia. I think fundraisers realized that King's would have been a hard sell after the Revolution. He was a brilliant student, but what happens is that the ferment of the Revolution has already started. So Hamilton is writing stirring pamphlets. The school was right near the Common, what's today City Hall Park in Lower Manhattan. And Hamilton gives these rabble-rousing, you know, speeches in the Commons. And then as things get more serious and violence starts, he is drilling a company of students in St. Paul's Churchyard, which actually is still there. It's immediately across the street from Ground Zero, and amazingly was, you know, not destroyed on 9/11, but it was right across the street. So, and then what happens, Hamilton becomes, now 1775, Hamilton becomes the captain of an artillery unit, and he is, as with everything, so brilliant doing this that he comes to the attention of several generals. And three or four generals invite him onto his staff, and Hamilton says no. But then comes the irresistible invitation by George Washington to become his aide-de-camp. Now, at that point, so now we're 1777, Hamilton would have been about 22, 23 years old. But he becomes such a valued member of Washington's staff that when you look at the minutes of the various councils of war during the Revolution, you'll see 10 generals listed, and then at the bottom it will say Colonel Hamilton. So here's this kind of boy wonder who's immediately, as Lynn says, the right hand of the father. It's a wonderful line. Yes, Hamilton is at the right hand of the father. But Hamilton, you know, anyone else would have been thrilled by that position. Hamilton is chafing. Because Hamilton, from the time that he was a boy, in fact, from our earliest letter that he wrote in his early teens, he's dreaming of battlefield glory. So he feels chained to the desk with Washington. Washington needed a great letter writer more than he needed another battlefield hero, because Washington actually had 14 political masters. He was dealing with the Continental Congress, but there were also 13 governors of the 13 states. So he had this vast correspondence with his 14 masters. And Hamilton was a great letter writer, and Washington would give him the gist of what the letter should say, and then out would pop this, you know, beautiful letter. And Hamilton learned to very much sort of write in the vein of George Washington. So there's friction between them, because as Lynn says, you know, Hamilton would rather fight, not right, which is accurately put. And then finally, Hamilton can stand it no longer. He kind of provokes a quarrel with Washington and quits his staff. But basically, Hamilton is just lining himself up for a battlefield assignment, which happens at Yorktown, which, of course, is the climactic battle of the war. And Hamilton finally achieves the battlefield heroics that he's been dreaming of since his early adolescence.
So going back briefly to his origins then, and I know that this is something that the musical maybe brings out as well, his feeling perhaps of being an outsider, which his later marriage, I suppose, almost does glean him a little bit of insider status, but he still has that maybe a chip on his shoulder. How much do you think that drove him to wanting conflict and wanting later duels and things?
It's a very good question. I think the point to emphasize here is his illegitimacy. I don't know about in England, but the United States, I think that, you know, half of all births now are to people who are technically illegitimate. We don't use the term anymore because the stigma of it has almost entirely disappeared. I mean, you never hear people describe that way anymore. But in the 18th century, those are kind of fighting words to say that someone was illegitimate, to call someone was a bastard. And on those occasions when that happened with Hamilton, by all accounts, he was thrown into a frenzy. And he said, you know, my birth has been the subject of the most humiliating censure. And so I think that it was very important for him as an outsider, not only to attain that kind of standing with Washington, but also, you know, he lacked what in the 18th century they called, you know, birth, breeding, and fortune, if you kind of use the language of a Jane Austen novel. And so he marries Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton, who's a member of this Anglo-Dutch royalty that has ruled New York since its earliest days. And Eliza Schuyler has all of these Van Cortlandt, Van Rensselaer relatives, not names to conjure with here, but certainly, you know, in New York, if you mention those names, those are kind of the aristocratic Dutch, you know, names of New York. And so it's rather amazing that she falls in love with Hamilton, and even more amazing that the Schuyler family, very, very aristocratic family in upstate New York, that they embrace him. The idea of embracing this young man who's kind of an illegitimate orphaned kid from the islands was very, very unusual at the time and is testimony to just how dazzling Hamilton was in person, because it was a very, very difficult society to break into. You know, Americans like to pretend that this snobbery doesn't exist in our country, but it most certainly does. And Hamilton manages to break through that and very much become part of the social establishment as well as the political establishment. It's a fairy tale story, and I think that one thing that you know, Lynn captures extremely well in the show is Hamilton's driven nature, just how determined he was in every respect, you know, in the social sphere, the political sphere, the economic sphere, you know, to attain his place in the world. And he does by dint of his talent.
You touched on it in your last answer, but I think it'd be great to cover Hamilton's genius in a financial sense. So it was in the late stages of the Revolutionary War, I think, that he began to really think ahead in terms of the financial institutions of the United States, the early United States. Can you perhaps explain the type of systems he was looking at and what he was advocating for?
Yeah, actually, you know, during the Revolutionary War, he's lugging from camp to camp enormous folio-sized volume, Malachy Postlethwaite's Dictionary of Trade and Commerce. And he's already kind of, you know, boning up for being Treasury Secretary. During the war, Hamilton was very closely studying the British system because he realized that Great Britain had a lot of advantages over the colonists. And one that was really foremost in his mind was Britain's financial power. That Britain had, you know, arranged its credit in a way that enabled it to raise money, you know, when war was needed. And so Hamilton is basically kind of studying, you know, the British system and then copying the British system in order to overtake the British system, maybe not unlike what a China is going through with the United States today. So that after the war, he establishes the first private bank in New York, the Bank of New York. He's not only a director, he sits there, he single-handedly, you know, writes the Constitution and bylaws for the bank. And then very significantly, when he is Treasury Secretary, he creates the first central bank in the United States, which is called the Bank of the United States, really the forerunner of what's today the Federal Reserve System. And as he's writing up the bylaws of the Bank of the United States, he's sitting there with the bylaws of the Bank of England on the desk. So he's kind of very self-consciously copying that system. He also, the single most important thing that Hamilton ever did in his life sounds at first blush very technical. And it was the assumption of state debt that by the time the federal government was formed and he became the first Treasury Secretary, the United States had used debt in order to finance the Revolutionary War. And the government was in arrears, both principal and interest on that debt. So essentially the government starts and it's bankrupt, and he's the Treasury Secretary. And he decides that he's going to pay off that debt in full. He you know, extends the deadline for repaying it. But he's determined to establish American credit. And he makes a very interesting decision that at first glance seems counterintuitive. There was $50 million in federal debt that the Continental Congress had incurred. And then there was $25 million that the state governments had independently incurred. Hamilton says to the states that he wants to assume the $25 million debt. In other words, he wants to take the money off their books and put it onto the books of the federal government. This seems counterintuitive. What government in history has voluntarily asked to increase debt and taken debt off the hands of other government entities? So why did he do that? Hamilton did it because he knew that if the federal government assumed that state debt, that it would forever after have a lock on revenues. And in fact, there was a famous dinner deal, and it's mentioned in the show. There's a dinner deal in which Hamilton felt so strongly about the state debt that he had a dinner with Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and Jefferson and Madison agreed that they would support the assumption of state debt, and in exchange, the U.S. Capitol would be put on the Potomac River, where Washington, D.C. is, in fact, today. Thomas Jefferson, in later years, said that it was the single biggest mistake of his career because it so tremendously centralized power in the federal government. He didn't realize what Hamilton's underlying agenda was. He didn't realize kind of what the underlying logic of the whole thing was. And so, you know, I always say to American audiences, we pay, you know, federal, state, and local taxes. I always say to American audiences that Americans to this day pay more in federal taxes than state, local. And it goes back to that dinner deal about the assumption of state debt. So Hamilton knew exactly what he was doing. But it was kind of characteristic of him that he would take something that seemed like a very technocratic program and embedded in that was a political agenda that would not immediately be apparent. Very clever, yeah.
And it was after the Revolutionary War that he was invited to join the Congress. And then he was a key figure in the forming of the Constitution.
Yeah, in fact, we know what happens. He's at a conference in Maryland. He personally issues the appeal to the Constitutional Convention. He attends it as a delegate from New York. He's the only New York delegate to sign it. And then what happens afterwards, no less important, because after the Constitution was approved in Philadelphia in 1787, it had to be ratified by the individual, by conventions in the individual states. So Hamilton, along with Madison and John Jay, Hamilton dreams up the idea that there'll be a series of essays that will defend the Constitution pretty much article by article. And they were called the Federalist Papers, and there were 85 of them. And over a six-month period, Hamilton somehow managed to write 51 of them, which would be an enormous enough achievement by itself. But we know that he was writing them while he had a full-time legal practice. So he was, as it were, writing these nights and weekends. And we have anecdotal evidence of, you know, Hamilton dashing off the final sentences and the printer would be sitting in the outer office and then kind of rush to print it. And the Federalist Papers are considered the greatest interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. And over the last two centuries, they have been cited more than 300 times by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is far more than any other document. So they have almost acquired the status of the Constitution itself. They're kind of held in that much reverence. And it's amazing because they really were, you know, work of journalism, pumped out under great pressure. And one of Hamilton's enormous achievements. And when you read them today, they're just almost letter perfect.
Time for another quick chat about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you want to get away in 2024, why not book a weekend package at one of Warner's most historic hotels? There's Littlecote House, which is a stunning Tudor manor in Hungerford, Studley Castle, a beautiful 19th century building in Warwickshire, or Home Lacey, a huge Herefordshire mansion that was once visited by Charles I. Whichever location you choose, you'll be able to enjoy a whole weekend of live talks from your favourite historians during your stay. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
It seems as though we can't talk about Alexander Hamilton without talking about Thomas Jefferson, his great political rival. And I suppose many people would have come to Alexander Hamilton likely first through the sphere of Thomas Jefferson. So could you maybe explain their political rivalries and how the significance of it in American history?
Yeah, well, what happens, during Washington's first term as president, so we're talking 1879, the federal government has just been forged under the new Constitution. Washington's cabinet consists of only three people. There's Henry Knox, Secretary of War. There's Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury. And there's Thomas Jefferson, who is Secretary of State. In order to understand the rivalry, first, I have to point out that Thomas Jefferson starts at the State Department with six people, Knox at the War Department with 12. Hamilton, because he has all these customs inspectors and revenue collectors, Hamilton's Treasury Department is immediately several hundred people, which was considered, by the standards of the day, a very large bureaucracy. So Hamilton, at age 34, and about a dozen years younger than Jefferson, is immediately more like the prime minister of the administration, because his Treasury Department is, you know, considerably more than 90% of the government. So there's that kind of rivalry. But then what happens was, you know, the founders of the United States all hoped that they would be spared the bane of parties, which they called factions at the time. But actually what happens within the first year or two of Washington's first term is that the two-party system arises, and to Washington's horror, it arises within his own cabinet from Hamilton and Jefferson. It was partly a personality clash. You know, Hamilton was extremely dashing and flamboyant. Thomas Jefferson was very quiet. He was very courtly. If you disagreed with Jefferson in person, he probably would not confront you. He would just sort of make a mental note that he was going to get back at you in his own quiet way, in his own quiet time. Hamilton would immediately sort of engage him and challenge him with kind of very different personalities. But they came to embody two different political philosophies. And these two different political philosophies still resonate through American politics to this day. Okay, some of the conflicts in their positions. Hamilton believed strongly in a powerful central government. Jefferson believed strongly in states' rights. Jefferson believed in legislative power. He thought the legislature was closest to the people. Hamilton believed in executive power and that kind of vigor in government. Very, very importantly, Jefferson believed in what we call strict construction of the Constitution. That is, unless some power was specifically delegated to the federal government that it did not possess it. Hamilton had a much more liberal interpretation of the Constitution, that he said, well, if these goals are specified in the Constitution, if measures that are means to those goals, you know, should be allowed. And this really kind of allows the government to tremendously expand its powers. So as I said, these things still resonate. And then very importantly, and I think I emphasize this in the book, and certainly Lynn emphasizes it in the show as well, Thomas Jefferson owned 200 slaves. And his defense of states' rights was very much a defense of the slavery in those southern states. Hamilton was an abolitionist during the war. He champions a plan to emancipate any slaves who are willing to fight for the Continental Army. Of course, the British were doing something very, very similar on the other side. And then after the war, Hamilton co-founds the first abolitionist society in New York. So I think more and more, you know, as time has gone on, when we look back, that the relationship between Jefferson and Hamilton looks different because, you know, when I was growing up, it was Thomas Jefferson was this perfect human being. He was the tribune of the common man, you know, and woman. And Hamilton was, you know, a fierce elitist. And then when you kind of look in terms of their attitude towards slavery, their attitudes towards Native Americans, Hamilton starts to look better and better, and Jefferson does not. So that's kind of been a major change in the way these figures are perceived.
So I'd love to talk about Eliza Hamilton, who bookends your marvelous book. You already spoke about how her marriage kind of legitimized Hamilton in some ways. So could you introduce us to Eliza and then maybe to her sister Angelica as well?
Absolutely. Well, one thing that I should point out is that at the time that I published the Hamilton biography in 2004, Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton was a complete blank in the American imagination. Americans knew a lot about Martha Washington, George's wife. They knew a lot about Dolly Madison, James Madison's wife. They knew a lot about Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife. They knew nothing, and I mean literally nothing about Eliza Hamilton was known. So one of the things that has most pleased me about both the book and the show is that we really put her on the map, and now she's like everyone's, you know, founding mother, which is really great. And there was a reason that we didn't know about Eliza, because she was an extremely humble and self-effacing and a very devout woman. And she always felt, you know, her husband's career, that was the important career. But, you know, what I discovered was that she lived for 50 years after her husband died in the duel. There's a beautiful rhymed couplet in the show. She comes out in the final scene and she says, I stop wasting time on tears. I live another 50 years. And during those 50 years, so she lives almost up until the Civil War era. During those 50 years, she establishes the first private orphanage in New York City. Of course, her husband had been an orphan. And she brings up hundreds of orphans. And she turned out to be this remarkably wonderful, selfless, strong-willed woman. And even though, I mean, she had to put up a lot with her husband, who got involved in a notorious sex scandal, but she was very, very loving and forgiving. And in all the letters she wrote after he died, she always referred to her sainted husband. So she was willing to forgive his excesses. Now, it was kind of a, I guess, menage a trois would not be quite the right expression for it, but everyone noticed that Hamilton was no less fascinated by his sister-in-law, Angelica, than by Eliza. In the show, when Hamilton meets Angelica, she's still single, which makes Ken more interesting. In reality, when they met, Angelica was already married. So almost by default, Hamilton was going to end up with Eliza. But everyone noticed that there was this unusual mutual fascination between Alexander Hamilton and Angelica. But Eliza was not jealous. In fact, Eliza was very, very proud of this. She loved the fact, I mean, she and Hamilton would write letters together to Angelica. Angelica had married a man named John Barker Church, who was both very, very fat and very, very rich. And Eliza was very proud. She had married Prince Charming, you know. Angelica, unlike Eliza, Eliza had strong, you know, political feelings, but Angelica was really someone who loved the company of powerful men and loved to discuss politics in books. She was much more emancipated, you know, in that way. And so she was very, very involved in Hamilton's career and advising him and kind of vicariously living through his life. And I think clearly if Angelica had been single at the time that Hamilton met the Schuyler sisters, there certainly is a good chance that he would have married Angelica. I think he truly loved Eliza. Angelica was kind of more more intellectual, and from the pictures, probably more alluring than Eliza was. And I think that Hamilton adored Eliza, but as Angelica sings in the musical, she knew right off that Hamilton was the kind of guy who would never be satisfied, and you know, would have a roving eye. And boy, she was right about that.
Aside from these two very significant relationships with the Schuyler sisters, he was obviously a very amorous figure outside of those as well.
Yeah, he was called the amorous Treasury Secretary. Lynn didn't use that in the show. At one point, he had it in there, but I'm sure he's the only Treasury Secretary in American history who's been known as the amorous Treasury Secretary.
Right, and well, yeah. I'd love to talk about what you call America's first great sex scandal, which shook the establishment pretty much, and his remarkable reaction to it as well.
Yeah, what happens in 1791, so really at the height of his powers as Treasury Secretary, the government at that point was temporarily in Philadelphia. And Hamilton was not only the most powerful person in the government, he was the most controversial person in the government, which meant that there were kind of a lot of political enemies who were waiting to pounce on him if he did something wrong. Well, what happens, he's home alone one day, knock on the door, very beautiful young woman named Mariah Reynolds. Is at the door. She spills out this lovelorn tale that she's been abandoned by her husband, James Reynolds, and asks Hamilton for financial help. And amazingly enough, Hamilton asks where she's living. She says a boarding house just two or three blocks away. And that night, he slips out of the house and goes to the boarding house. And he said that when he got to the boarding house, Mrs. Reynolds was standing at the top of the stairway. And he said he went up the stairs, and he said when he got to the top of the stairs that Mrs. Reynolds made it clear that, quote, other than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable. And they then went into the bedroom, and this affair started. And the affair went on for a year. And maybe a month after it started, who appears but Mr. James Reynolds? And James Reynolds confronts Hamilton with the affair, but James Reynolds really doesn't want to stop the affair. What James Reynolds wants is to blackmail Hamilton, which he does, and Hamilton starts paying money. Now, this is completely crazy on Hamilton's part. Again, he's the most powerful man in the government. He has all these enemies, you know, who are sort of looking for something to pounce on, and he's paying money to this kind of lowlife, James Reynolds. Well, he was very, very lucky that there was a moment where three of his Jeffersonian opponents have heard that he's paying money to Mr. James Reynolds. But what they'd heard, which was incorrect, was that he was paying the money to James Reynolds because they were illegally speculating in Treasury securities together. And so the three Jeffersonians, and actually in the show, it's Jefferson, Madison, and Burr. In reality, it was three Jeffersonians, but not Jefferson, Madison, Burr, who confront him. And Hamilton says, oh, no, you completely have misunderstood. why I was paying him the money. I was paying him the money for the favor of his wife's company. So they said, oh, we're so sorry to bother you. We didn't realize that, that was considered, you know, good explanation. And then it was not until about 5 or 6 years later that a pamphlet was published by a man named James D. Callender, who was close to the Jeffersonians. He publishes a pamphlet in which he says that he kind of repeats the error that Hamilton was paying James Reynolds this money because of illicit treasury speculation. Hamilton then makes this bizarre decision that he's going to not only refute this, but refute this excruciating length. So he publishes a 95-page pamphlet. 95-page pamphlet in which he reproduces, not only tells this whole story in great detail, but reproduces his correspondence with Mrs. Reynolds and all these kind of crazy love letters. Why did he do that? Hamilton felt that in order to clear his public name, he had to sully his private name. But even, you know, Hamilton's closest friends and greatest admirers thought that a kind of delicately worded paragraph or two would have done the trick. They couldn't figure out why he needed to publish a 95-page pamphlet. And, of course, there was nothing that could have been more humiliating for his wife or his family than this. It was almost kind of like a short novel that he wrote about this. And writing projects with Hamilton tended to take on a life of their own. You know, once he started writing, he couldn't stop. And so I think as much as the scandal itself, his response to it, this kind of excessive verbiage that he devotes to it, really called into question his judgment of why on earth he would have done this. Hamilton, you know, like a lot of brilliant people, Hamilton had some real blind spots because he thought he was writing this sort of brilliant pamphlet that would clear him forever. And then it comes out and it has exactly the opposite effect that he had intended and pretty much guaranteed that he would never be president.
It's a remarkable defense of his political honor. And I think these affairs of honor, as you call them in the book, are very important to him throughout his whole life, his whole career. So maybe you could introduce some listeners who might not be familiar with the nature of dueling and the way in which it would have defended honor and how it played a part in Hamilton's life.
Dueling, it was really an honor culture. I think that in situations today where someone insults us or maligns us in some way, we would be likely to sue them for libel and take them to court. That was a possibility in the 18th century, but under this, you know, dueling code, if someone insulted you who was your social equal, you didn't take them to court. You would issue a challenge for a duel. Now, most duels did not actually end up on the dueling ground. Or even if they did end up on the dueling ground, each participant would pick a second, and the seconds, even on the dueling ground, would be trying to negotiate a solution, usually in the form of an apology. So the duel itself, the possibility of, you know, being injured, or even, you know, being killed, that sort of concentrated everyone's, you know, mind on it, and the seconds would try to negotiate a solution. Hamilton actually had been involved in many of these so-called affairs of honor. The only thing unusual about what happened at the end of his life with Aaron Burr was that in all the previous affairs of honor, it was Hamilton who was the aggressor. It was Hamilton who was one who was kind of sending the threatening letters and kind of, you know, threatening the duels. And so all of those were, in fact, resolved without any violence at the end. So what happens with Aaron Burr, because he and Burr had been legal rivals, they'd been military rivals, they'd been political rivals, and Burr had felt, they were the two major political figures from New York State, Burr felt kind of at every point in his career that Hamilton was the one who was stymieing him. And then finally what happens in 1804, at an Albany dinner party, Hamilton utters a so-called despicable opinion about Burr. This gets into the newspapers, not the specifics of it. It's just characterized as a despicable opinion. And so now, for the first time, Hamilton is involved in an affair of honor, but it's Burr who wants to know what the despicable opinion is, and he wants Hamilton to apologize for the despicable opinion, which Hamilton refuses to do. So this escalates. This goes to the dueling ground. And one very important thing that 2.5 years earlier, Hamilton's son, Philip, his eldest son, had been killed in a duel, also on the New Jersey shore, not too far from where Hamilton will die. And so Hamilton, because of that experience, has kind of a complicated attitude towards dueling, because on the one hand, his son has died in a duel, so officially he no longer believes in dueling. On the other hand, he felt that as a political figure, as a military figure, if he refused the challenge to go to the dueling ground, that he would be branded a coward. It's a little hard for us to think ourselves into this mindset. And so what he decides to do, and it was not uncommon at the time, he decides he's going to go to the dueling ground, so he'll show his courage, he's going to show up with Burr, but he's going to waste his shot, he's going to fire in the air, and then hope against hope that Burr will do the same. But as we know, Burr did not. And Burr, you know, kills him, well, mortally wounds him with the first shot. Hamilton is then rowed across the Hudson River back to Manhattan, and within 24 hours is dead. And it's kind of a very moving moment at the very end. It's not in the musical, because in the musical he has only two children, only one of whom was seen, whereas in reality he had seven children. He had Eliza as he was lying there bleeding to death. He said to Eliza he wanted Eliza to line up all of the children at the foot of the bed. And she did, and they all were standing there. And he took one look at all the children and then shut his eyes. He wanted that to be his last, you know, image of them. Kind of quite a dramatic moment in his life in American history, you know, and then he died.
It is a remarkable history, a remarkable end to a remarkable life. But I might say that it's not necessarily the most obvious fodder for a hip-hop musical at first glance.
Yeah.
So I'd love to talk to you about your work on the musical, which Lin-Manuel Miranda has written, and it's a massive hit, obviously. As a historical consultant on the musical, can you talk a little bit about your work on it and how it came about?
Yeah, so the story was this. Okay, the biography came out in 2004. I met Lin in the fall of 2008. He was still starring in his first musical. It was called In the Heights, which was a very autobiographical musical about growing up in a Latino neighborhood on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I found out through a mutual friend that Lin had read the book and made a huge impression on him. And I went to see In the Heights and then went backstage to meet Lin. And we had this unforgettable conversation where I said, Lin, I gather my book made an impression on you. And he started telling me he had been reading the book on vacation in Mexico. And he said hip-hop songs started rising off the page as he was reading it. And he said to me very earnestly, he said, you know, Ron Hamilton's life is a classic hip-hop narrative. And I thought to myself, pal, I have no idea what you're talking about. But what Lin felt, Lin had two points of entry. One was that this hip-hop narrative idea that for him, you know, hip-hop heroes are people who had written their way out of poverty or obscurity kind of through their power, the power of language. So that was one thing. The other, Lin is from a Puerto Rican family, and so he saw the Hamilton story as kind of classic immigrant story. Lin's father, who's from Puerto Rico, had come to New York in his late teens, knowing very little English, ended up, I think, getting a PhD, you know, and having a very successful career as a political consultant to various New York mayors. So, and so the very first time that I met Lin, he said to me, would you like to be the historical consultant to this non-existent musical? So I laughed and I said to him, you mean you want me to tell you when something is wrong? And he said, yes. He said, I want the historians to take this seriously, which they have.
And do you think it's an effective medium to bring people to this history?
Well, I asked him. That was actually the first question that I ever asked him that day. I said, can this be the vehicle for telling, this is a very complicated man, it's a very complicated story. I mean, usually the world of musicals is kind of a make-believe world with two-dimensional characters. This was very complex. And he said, Ron, I'm going to educate you in hip-hop. And he pointed out a number of things that are very germane to the show. Number one, because the hip-hop lyrics are very dense and rapid, you can pack enormous amount of information into them. It's really, Hamilton is a little under 3 hours, but it's really like a six-hour show squashed into 3 hours because the hip-hop is so compressed. You start pointing out things like the hip-hop, it's a lot of rhyme, there are rhymed endings, there's internal rhyme, enormous amount of wordplay, and all of these things are sort of very, very important to the show. So I didn't know anything about hip-hop then. Now I know a tiny little bit about hip-hop because of the show, but it really works. And I think the hip-hop works. And in the show, Hamilton sings in hip-hop. The whole show is not in hip-hop by any means. But in the show, Hamilton sings in hip-hop because he's the youngest of the founders, so he's cool, so he sings in hip-hop. And I think that there's like a perfect match between the intensity, the density of the hip-hop, and Lin presents Hamilton as this very driven character. So the music and the personality work together perfectly.
So the musical, as we're talking, is very shortly to open in the West End.
Yep.
And your remarkable book, published by Head of Zeus, is out now. Thank you so much for your time today, Ron.
Oh, this has been delightful. Thank you.
So that was Ron Chernow talking to Eleanor Evans. You can find out more about Hamilton the Musical at hamiltonmusical.com. And that is about it for today, but please do rejoin us next Monday when we'll be speaking to Helen Castor about Lady Jane Grey.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.
Before you go, one final word about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you fancy a break in 2024, you can now choose from three fantastic weekend packages at some of the most historic Warner Hotels. For instance, Littlecote House is set in a stunning location in Hungerford, which has played host to Romans, a Civil War army, and the planning of the D-Day landings. Meanwhile, Studley Castle in Warwickshire was used as a training camp for the Women's Land Army during the World Wars. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.